just down from the largest square in the city, and this, of course, used to be called Elizabeth Boulevard, after Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain, because she once passed down here as a guest of the Shah. After the revolution, it was renamed, of course. It's now called Gardener's Boulevard. Being like a garden, it's green. We're still in the winter here, and you can see some of the trees are green, and others just about to come into bud. What I know as I walk around here, this huge city, about the size of London, is the complex society which, over the years and the centuries, Britain has tried to undermine, invade, interfere with, manage its economy, undermine its politics. And it continues to do that to this day. And we see that with the involvement of the British government and its intelligence agencies in spying against Iran, and indeed in activities where the British have been involved in direct actions against Iran, of course supporting some of the protests which they see as being in their interests.
When talking about the history of British interference in Iran, Iranians refer to Britain as the old fox, a cunning nation that pursues its interests via trickery rather than simply by force. I went over to visit the British Embassy in central Tehran. A lot of Iranians suspect that some of the social chaos there is here consciously planned within the walls of Britain's embassy compound.
There are patches of the wall which have been painted white and orange, where graffiti has been painted over by the embassy staff itself. And of course, almost as soon as the graffiti is painted over, more graffiti appears. And the graffiti that is here is mainly in Farsi and mainly in support of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And indeed, you see one here on my left, 120, which is the time that Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by the Americans with impliedly British support. And there's also another one there in Farsi which says, you can wash the walls, but you can't wash the history. And I think that's really interesting and evocative. I also see something in English to the left here. It says, Free Ireland. And that, of course, is part of the issue here, because this street that we're on is now the front door of the embassy. It used to be the side door of the embassy, but they changed it in 1981 when the Iranian government named the street that the embassy was on Bobby Sands Street, after the Irish Republican Army hunger striker who died in May 1981 on hunger strike for political status in jails in the north of Ireland. So there's a real sense for me here of a connection between popular ideas and popular beliefs about Britain and some of the politics of anti-imperialism in the UK, including, of course, the struggle in Ireland for self-determination. So here we are in the famous Bobby Sands Street, named after Bobby Sands, the officer commanding the IRA prisoners in the prisons in the north of Ireland. In 1981, he and his comrades went on hunger strike to demand political status, that they were not criminals, that they were acting politically to end the British occupation of Ireland. And he was the first one to die on hunger strike. 10 men died that year on hunger strike. And before he died, he was elected as a British MP in Fermanagh and South Tyrone in the spring of 1981. And that exploded the Irish conflict and led to the involvement of Sinn Féin, the political party associated with the IRA, into politics, and led in the end to the stalemate which ended the conflict in the north of Ireland. So it's an important sign of the solidarity between the Iranian people and the struggle in Ireland, which is really very interesting to see even after all these years. So as you can see, this is Bobby Sands Street, and this is the wall which the ambassador hasn't painted over. And every panel along here has a slogan, an anti-British slogan, or a pro-Irish slogan, slogans about Qasem Soleimani. But this was never painted over. Of course, the reason they painted over one wall was as a photo opportunity, so you could come out and say, look, we have a white wall here, painted over it, Iranians have come and helped me. But of course, it was just there as a photo opportunity because all the other walls have not been painted over. Just being in the metro, which is smaller and much less dirty than the Paris metro, the London Underground, or indeed the New York metro. We've just come down from the north of the city, and it's just like any other metro. It's been here since 1999. It was started before the revolution in 1979, and eventually it was created and started working in 1999. So, you know, we've just been on the metro. It was warm, it was clean, it was quick. It's like porridge in Scotland. One of the main national dishes is porridge, which is made of oats. And it's extremely similar to that. Sometimes people have it with sugar, but mainly they have it with salt. Right, so here we are at the National Museum of the Islamic Revolution and Holy Defence. And I'm looking forward to going inside. And we're going to go inside and see quite a lot of information about the Iran-Iraq war, which of course was a war which was sponsored by the West and in which the Iraqis used Western-supplied chemical weapons, the weapons which the West subsequently, of course, allegedly went into Iraq to remove. And so I'm anticipating that I will see a lot of stuff here that I was not aware of. Foundational moment in Shia Islam, but which in the UK these days is used as a lightning rod to represent anti-Semitism. So anyone who refers to Kabar, and there are rhymes and songs which are sometimes used in public demonstrations in the UK, is regarded by the Zionists as being anti-Semitic, because for them what happened in Kabar was a massacre of Jews, and it's an instance, a very early instance, they would say, of anti-Semitism. Now, of course, that's not what happened in Kabar, and it was a dispute of taxes, there was a battle, certainly, and the Jews went on living in the area afterwards. But it shows the way in which historical sources and, indeed, theological history is distorted in the contemporary period by the Zionists in order to marginalise Muslims active in political life in the UK. Now, the particular example I'm thinking of where that happened recently was the first black Muslim elected president of the National Union of Students, who was never even allowed to take office because she had a campaign against her by the Zionists, and she was removed successfully by the Zionists after an inquiry led by a lawyer who was also a Zionist. And that's the way in which the use of history is used today by the Zionists in order to inhibit, prohibit and suppress the role of Muslims in political life in the UK and indeed all over the West. We marched when Halab jail was bombed with chemical weapons, and there's a tree in the park near where I used to live, very close to where I used to live, called the Halab jail tree, which commemorates the victims of that. So people know in Scotland and indeed in Britain about the chemical weapons that were used by Saddam Hussein, and indeed about the fact they were supplied by the British.
Of the first time I survived a chemical attack was when I was 17. So, you know, for me, it's very personal. A nerve agent was used, and we were in the middle of a serious operation that was to take the Majnun Islands inside Iraq. and two Iraqi planes bombed our positions. We thought that the bombs hadn't exploded. They were rockets. Eight rockets were fired at us. We thought that they didn't explode, but we were mistaken. They were chemical. They're chemical agents, and the explosions are very small. We started to lose our ability to breathe, and we all collapsed. It was like being strangled. So, you know, it's very literally we were being strangled by the Europeans and Americans, because those chemical weapons were provided by Germany and by a number of other countries in Europe, and the military intelligence to use those chemical weapons was provided by the United States, and the political cover was provided by all of them. Some say the Americans also provided the ability, helped with chemical weapons. They were involved. That was my first experience.
But we see here the use of those weapons in the Iran-Iraq war, and we also see the way in which they can be used in geopolitics in later years. So, for example, in Syria, the whole question about the use of chemical weapons was used as a means, it was weaponized to try and legitimize further Western intervention and bombing of Syria. So the alleged attacks using sarin and Ghouta and Khan el-Sukun, the alleged chlorine attacks in Douma and in many other places, these were by and large constructed by the opposition to President Assad, and were in fact led, the fabrications of these incidents were led by the British intelligence agency MI6, with a little bit of help from the French. And that's a lesson we should learn, that not only are chemical weapons an appalling weapon, but the appallingness of them can be used and weaponized by the very states which produced them in the first place.
We had just gone through, we were experiencing the last attack of Iraq. It was the last few days of the war. And there was a small piece of land that the Iraqis wanted to take. And they attacked us with mustard gas. Which, for me, the first thing that came to mind were the scenes that I'd seen in the hospital. And you know, the problem with mustard gas is that a lot of people continue to die. A lot of people died during corona, but over the years, many of the people, because it damages their lungs, and then it gets worse, or they get cancer. One of my very close friends, people are still dying. The brother of one of my colleagues in this building just died 5-6 years ago because of his chemical wounds.
The Americans are opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran, whatever it does, unless it becomes a non-Islamic Republic of Iran and becomes a U.S. client. I mean, that's the rule, isn't it? If you're not a client of the U.S. and you do things which challenge U.S. power, then you become an enemy of the U.S. and they will find whatever they can to attack you. So they tried to find chemical weapons allegations against the Syrians, which had been constructed by the British in the first place. They will do anything they can. It's not... The U.S. is not your friend. And actually, you know, let's put it more starkly, it's about the power of the white nations over all the rest of the nations of the world, whether they're black or Arabic or Slavic or whatever, it doesn't matter. The white nations want to rule. I mean, it's a crude way of saying it, but in the end, that's the fact of the matter.
The United Nations Security Council Resolution 598 was the main cause of an immediate ceasefire between Iran and Iraq. The eight-year war, or Holy Defence, as it's known in Iran, was brutal. Almost all of the world stood behind Saddam Hussein and put the new Islamic Republic under serious pressure, even using banned chemical weapons. But the Islamic Republic was not defeated. As a result, Western geopolitical strategists concluded alternative means would have to be found. Terrorism and hybrid warfare were amongst the strategies they adopted.
The reason Mossad killed the scientists is because they want to disrupt what they perceive as the Iranian nuclear program. And that's the reason, isn't it? I mean, that's the
purpose of the assassination, and of course it's also to show that they can do it, that they can operate inside Iran. MI6 ought to be targeting the Zionist movement and Mossad, because they are subverting British politics, but they don't see that. I mean, it used to be the case. I mean, in 1951, I think it was, MI5 discovered that there was a Mossad spy inside the Joint Intelligence Organisation in the UK, and they got rid of him, expelled him, the case files have now been written up and revealed in the National Archives, and they say, well, now we understand that Israel is a hostile state, and it's been a hostile state ever since, but there's no recognition of that, or very little recognition of that now in the intelligence service. Standing beside the graves, the tombs of a significant number of martyrs, including several of the Iranian nuclear scientists assassinated by the Mossad. In one case, the most recent case, where the Mossad have bragged about doing the killing, but where it appears that MI6, the British intelligence agency, may have had a role in this killing. And that wouldn't be surprising, but it's a source, really, of shame that Britain is involved in this kind of activity still to this day, after all the misdeeds that Britain has done in Iran and many other countries. So, yeah, that's all.
It's the power of narratives, it's the power of repetition, it's the power of media that leads people to begin to think in a certain way, talk in a certain way, walk in a certain way, behave in a certain way. And that is a part of hybrid warfare. Doesn't mean that everything that the media says is false, everything or but the point is that it is a tool. It is a tool for warfare. I think that 2023 is going to be a very extraordinary year.
Yeah.
Things are falling apart. But when things fall apart, they get very dangerous. The only way for real liberation is for the decolonization of the mind. Because as long as our minds are colonized, then there is no such thing as liberation. Even if you expel the empire from your land, you're still a slave of sorts.
Yeah.
So I think that the most important issue is that this movement towards religion also has this impact that it lessens the fear of the hegemon, it lessens the fear of the dominant power, and it creates a culture of resistance. For example, when Obama began the maximum pressure sanctions and there was a lack of medicine and people lost their jobs and families were broken, and my own father, who is a physician, and you know he's a professor, he couldn't find his medicine,
yeah.
So he'd have to use medicine that where the date had already expired, and so I mean, and then you have cancer patients and others who have, you know, they have to buy expensive medicine, and it wasn't available or extreme. So you know, people were literally dying, losing jobs. Society was being severely damaged. Families were being wrecked because they were losing their livelihoods. And
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime's blockade of the Gaza Strip has been taking a huge toll on the local population since 2007. Gaza health officials say hundreds of renal patients are now at grave risk due to the blockade, with hospitals running short on medicine and supplies. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, at least 1,100 Palestinian kidney patients, including 38 children, are facing an interruption of life-saving treatment in Gaza. Imagine this. You and your beloved family members suffer from kidney failure, but you are living in a tiny, impoverished region that is in a constant state of war. Worse, this region is under a hermetic military siege. Worse still, the few dialysis machines available to you and over 1,000 patients with the same condition are about to become obsolete. It is a nightmare scenario for anyone, anywhere. For Gaza, however, this is part of everyday life. A routine of sorts that even those among us who are sympathetic to the plight and the struggle of Palestinians have learned to accept as something evil, but almost an inevitable reality. The Palestine Chronicle correspondent in Gaza was invited to a grim press conference recently, where the Ministry of Health in the besieged strip declared that all dialysis services in the small enclave will cease to operate in a matter of days. The reason? There is an unprecedented shortage of medical supplies necessary for dialysis clinics to continue with their services. In the press conference in Gaza City, Dr. Ashraf Abu Mahdi, director of the pharmaceutical department in the health ministry, said that the difficult and dangerous situation is a direct outcome of the shortage of medicines and medical supplies, which continues to haunt Gaza's health services. According to Dr. Abu Mahdi, at least 1,100 patients with kidney failure, including 38 children, will not receive life-saving treatment due to the lack of medicines. Adding, today these patients live with great fear and anxiety about their inability to receive the dialysis service due to the lack of the needed medical consumables. This is not the first time that Gaza's doctors have made such dire warnings and ultimately desperate calls for help. Aside from the support of a few Arab and international NGOs, quite often the tragic warnings fall on deaf ears. Simply put, the international community is unable, or rather unwilling, to confront the Zionist regime with the needed seriousness that would end Tel Aviv's blockade on Gaza. This blockade has been in place since 2007, at a horrific cost of untold suffering and an ever-growing death toll. The fabricated regime of Israel is banning the transport and shipment of medical supplies to the hospitals of the enclave, putting the lives of thousands of kidney patients at risk. Dr. Abu Mahdi maintained, adding, hospitals in Gaza almost ran out of dialysis filters, canals and blood transfusion tubes. Dr. Abu Mahdi called on human rights organizations to condemn the Zionist regime's practices against Gaza patients. The Israeli regime occupation deprives the patients of treatment inside the Gaza Strip, prevents them from leaving for treatment outside Gaza and refuses to provide them with medical and diagnostic equipment. According to the Middle East Monitor, the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza has recently appealed for help to save 1,100 kidney failure patients, including 38 children, after treatment kits had run out in the enclave. Director of International Cooperation at the Ministry, Dr. Marwan Abu Saadeh, appealed to all concerned bodies to urgently intervene to save the lives of the patients due to the acute shortage of the necessary medical supplies needed for them. He reiterated that the severe shortage poses a threat to the lives of 1,100 kidney failure patients, including 38 children. He also said that all medical staff for dialysis services, including blood filters, cannulas, and blood tubes, had run out. The Ministry of Health provides more than 13,000 dialysis sessions for patients with kidney failure in its hospitals every month, which requires providing more than 13,000 filters, 13,000 blood tubes, and 26,000 blood cannulas per month. The fabricated regime of Israel's 16-year siege on the Gaza Strip has been blamed for the lack of necessary medical supplies.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers, sisters, dear listeners. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Mafatih al-Hayat, Keys of Life. We are looking at the key of life, which is family and relatives, and specifically we were talking about children. And previously we were saying that it is recommended, emphasized that we have children, and also we need to know that there are rights when it comes to children. One of these rights of children is that we must choose a good name for them. And that is their right. It is not my choice and the wife's choice or the spouse's choices to, you know, randomly pick a name and or sometimes even fight over a name. No, you have a human being that's going to live, have his own identity, and he's not going to be a child forever. At some stage he will grow up and he has to see his life. You have to make sure that you choose a name that is proper and suitable for a human being to be proud of in this world and in the hereafter. And that's why the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he says, "Inna awwala ma yanhalu bihi ahadukum maladahu al-ismu al-hasan." The first, you know, trait that you will give your child, the first attribute that you will give your child is a beautiful, good name. فَلْيُحْسِنُ أَحَدَكُمْ إِسْمَ وَلَدَ. Then let him choose the best of names for his child. When you have a child and you call him, I don't know, a weird name, like, for example, Arabs back then and even now, they use animal names like cheetah and lions and I don't know. They use animal names to name their children, which is awful. What kind of trait am I giving to my child if I name after an object, after a tree, or after something that I like? The Prophet says, make sure you choose a good name because that will become who he is. And he also said, إِذَا سَمَّيْتُمَ الْوَلَدَ مُحَمَّدًا. Now, in the narrations, interestingly enough, it's said that when a person has a child, For the first 7 days, he needs to call him Muhammad. And obviously, because the Prophet, he did say that, أول ما ينحل به أحدكم ولده الاسم. The first thing that you can give your child, like when it comes to traits and personality, is that when you call him Muhammad, you kind of form this person on the personality of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa ala. So the hadith says it's mustahab, recommended, that we call our children Muhammad for the first 7 days, and then you can give them something else, or you can just leave it Muhammad, or Muhammad, and you add another name to it, make it a compound name. So he said, if you do call your kids Muhammad, إِذَا سَمَّيْتُمَ الْوَلَدَ مُحَمَّدًا, then there are even extra requirements. فَأَكْرِمُوهُ, first, be kind and generous to this person. You have to respect him. وَأَوْسُعُوا لَهُ فِي الْمَجَالِسِ, that when he comes to sit in a gathering, open the space for him, give him a good space. Why? Because he is carrying the name Muhammad. وَلَا تُقَبِّحُوا لَهُ وَجْهَا, don't, you know, frown in his face or make it look as if you're uncomfortable with him. That's just for having the name Muhammad. And so when, like we said, because the name Muhammad itself, it holds a special position in Islam and in the Quran. The hadith says, مَا مِن مَأَدَةٍ وُضَعَتْ وَحَضَرْ عَلَيْهَا مِنْ اسْمُ أَحْمَدْ أَوْ مُحَمَّدْ إِلَّا قُدِّسَ ذَلِكَ الْمَنْزِلِ فِي كُلَّيَا مَرَتَيْنِ. Every time that where a meal is brought forth and there's a person named Ahmad or Muhammad, this house itself will be blessed twice a day. Let us take a short break and then we will come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. Now, we spoke about the child's name. We need to speak about the child's health, which is also something that the narrations did not neglect. The narration in this regard, they kind of even go to the beginning of things. Like before the birth of the child, before even the child becomes a fetus in his mother's womb. You see that even the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when a person wants to get close to his wife and they want to have intimacy, and they have to be careful that there are good times to think of having a child, there are bad times of having a child, and the times and the circumstances do affect the health and the mentality of the child once they're born. So, for example, we have in a hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he encouraged people to, you know, be intimate with their wives while their wives are on their period. And he says, فَإِن فَعَلَ ذَلِكَ, if a person comes close to his wife while she's on her period, وَخَرَجَ الْوَلَدُ مَجْذُومًا أَوْ بِهِ بُرْسٌ فَلَا يَمُلُّمَنَّ إِلَّا نَفْسَهُ, and the child comes with physical diseases on his body, apparent diseases on his body, on his skin, and he becomes deformed, then he should not blame anyone but himself. And also the prophet says, when a person had, you know, he had a wet dream and he wakes up, let him not come close to his wife, حَتَّى يَخْتَسِلْ, until he has a shower. If he had a wet dream before and he wakes up without having a shower and he comes close to his wife, or a wife comes close to her husband and they have intimacy, and then the child becomes insane or crazy, or, you know, a person with mindless brain, then he says he should not blame except himself. And even we have like a very thorough hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam in the book Tuhaf al-Uqul, where he, I think it's about 3-4 pages long, one hadith, where he instructs Amir al-Mu'minin of the good times and bad times when one comes next to his wife. Amongst which he says to him, Ya Ali, do not come close to your wife on the 15th of every month, the night of the 15th. Wala laylatul hilal, and also in the night where the moon is born. And he says to him, he's trying to explain why, أَمَّا رَأَيْتَ الْمَجْنُونَ يُسْرَعْ فِيَتِ الْهِلَالِ وَيَتُ النُّصْفُ كَثِيرًا, I saw that most kids become insane and they lose their minds, like the, you know, as we call them, impaired mentally on the 9th of 15th, those who their birth happened on the night of the 15th and the night where the moon is born. So this is just of some of the instructions of the Ahl Bayt in this regard, and there's plenty more where that came from. We will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
A new model suggests that in 250 million years, all land will collide into a supercontinent that boosts warming and pushes mammals to extinction. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote, researchers predict up to 92% of Earth could be uninhabitable to mammals in 250 million years. The planet's land masses are expected to form a supercontinent, driving volcanism and increases to carbon dioxide levels that will leave most of its land barren. Hanna Davis, a geologist at GFZ German Research Center for Geosciences in Potsdam, said, "It does seem like life is going to have a bit more of a hard time in the future," adding, "It's a bit depressing. Earth is currently thought to be in the middle of a supercontinent cycle as its present-day continents drift. The last supercontinent, Pangea, broke apart about 200 million years ago. The next, dubbed Pangea Ultima, is expected to form at the equator in about 250 million years as the Atlantic Ocean shrinks and emerged Afro-Eurasian continent crashes into the Americas. Modeling the climate of the new supercontinent described on September 25th in Nature Geoscience, Alexander Farnsworth at the University of Bristol, UK, and his colleagues found that much of Pangea Ultima will experience temperatures of higher than 40 degrees Celsius, making it uninhabitable to most mammalian life. As they merge together and then drift apart, the continents will drive volcanic activity that spews huge amounts of CO2 up into the atmosphere, says Farnsworth, and that will heat up the planet. Farnsworth says regions in the middle of the supercontinent, far from the oceans, would turn into deserts that are unlivable, except for every specialized mammals. The lack of moisture would also diminish the amount of silica that is washed into the oceans, which usually removes CO2 from the atmosphere. Increased solar radiation will cause further heating. The sun is predicted to be 2.5% more luminous at the time of Pangea Ultima's formation, a result of the star having burnt more of its hydrogen fuel and shrunk its core, increasing its rate of nuclear fusion. In a worst-case scenario in which CO2 levels reach 1,120 parts per million, more than double current levels, just 8% of the planet's surface, coastal and polar regions would be habitable to most mammalian life compared with about 66% today. This would lead to a mass extinction, says Farnsworth, adding, it wouldn't just be for mammals, it could be for plant life as well and other types of life. What comes out of it is anyone's guess. In other mass extinctions, a new species tends to dominate. Carbon emissions caused by human activity were not considered by the researchers who focused on long-term climate modeling. Davis, who has previously studied the formation of Pangea Ultima, says that it is possible that some mammalian life might survive the environmental changes. She says, whether or not they all go extinct is just one outcome, but it's not the only outcome. It's also not certain where Pangea Ultima will form. Farnsworth modeling assumes it will coalesce in the warm tropics, but other scenarios suggest that it could form on top of the North Pole, leading to cooler conditions where life might fare better. There is some evidence that Pangea and other previous supercontinents had large interior deserts, says Davis, which decreased the area of habitable land and led to extinctions. She says, you see similar things happening in the end Triassic extinction event around 200 million years ago. If humans are still around in 250 million years, Fons Wolf speculates that they might have found ways to adapt, with Earth resembling the 1965 science fiction novel Dune. He asks, do humans become more specialist in desert environments, become more nocturnal or keep in caves? I would suspect if we can get off this planet and find somewhere more habitable, that would be more preferable. It might not be all doom and gloom, however. Davy says there have been extinction events in the past and will be extinction events in the future. I think life will make it through this one. It's just kind of a grim period. According to the New York Times, currently humans are heating the planet by releasing more than 40 billion tons of carbon from fossil fuels each year. If global warming continues unabated, biologists fear it will lead to the extinction of a number of species, while people will be unable to survive the heat and humidity in large swathes of the planet. On Panga Ultima, Dr. Vance Wolf and his colleagues concluded things will probably get far worse for mammals like us. The researchers found that almost all of Panga Ultima could easily become too hot for any mammal to survive. They might disappear in a mass extinction.
Hidden Files.
Well, there's a distinct and qualitative difference between one breaking a law for one's own individual self-interest or violating it in the interests of a class or a people whose oppression is expressed either directly are indirectly through that particular law. Well, the former might be called a criminal, though in many instances he is a victim. But the latter, as a reformist or revolutionary, is interested in universal social change. Captured, he or she is a political prisoner. Well, this is an excerpt from writings by former political prisoner, black revolutionary activist and professor, Dr. Angela Davis. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, you heard the definition of who is a political prisoner, according to this philosopher and activist. But the United States denies ever having any political prisoners. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who've been incarcerated in the U.S. over the decades who would say otherwise. Now, some of them have now died in prison. Some have been released, and others are still incarcerated after being in prison for more than four decades. Well, many of these individuals were involved in revolutionary movements in the 1960s. At the time, most of the activists were teenagers or in their 20s. Imagine that. Now, they say that they were fighting against settler colonialism and oppression. Now, these individuals are elderly in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s. They have endured many decades in prison and have spent much of their time even in solitary confinement. Many of them are ill, and lawyers have petitioned for them to be released on the basis of compassion. However, the U.S. is still adamant about keeping them behind bars. Why?
why American authorities felt that the Black Panthers were such a threat, and the reason why the U.S. destroyed this group and many other black nationalist groups. What exactly were they demanding? They wanted freedom and the power to determine the destiny of black and oppressed communities. The group believed that self-determination was key to ending their oppression, and they wanted to control the institutions in their communities. The Black Panthers were also seeking full employment for African Americans and other people of color. Due to the fact that black communities had been exploited for hundreds of years, the group wanted an end to the theft by the capitalist system of black people. They believed that the U.S. government was racist and prevented black Americans from excelling. They demanded what was promised to them after slavery, and that was 40 acres of land and two mules, or the financial equivalent of it. The Black Panthers wanted decent housing for black people and other minorities. Housing, which was fit to live in. And the group was also demanding that decent education be provided to black Americans. They wanted what they called true history to be taught, which meant exposing the true nature of American imperialism, as well as teaching the reality of how black Americans had been exploited and how they contributed to society. The Black Panthers were looking at many aspects of life, including health, and they wanted free health care for all black and oppressed people. And they wanted preventive medicine to be practiced in oppressed communities. One of the first demands of the Black Panthers was an end to police brutality and the murder of black people and other oppressed people inside the United States. The Black Panthers were very aware of the connection between their own oppression and the oppression of others. Thus, they wanted an end to all wars of aggression by the United States. They said the goal of these wars was to expand domination and the oppression of people around the world. The organizations wanted the freedom for all black and oppressed people being held in all U.S. prisons. The Panthers felt that to begin with, their incarceration was due to the racist and oppressive system. And they also believed that any trials held for alleged crimes should be done so in front of a jury of peers. To sum it up, what the Black Panthers wanted for their people and others were land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and people's community control of modern technology. Had these demands been met, it would have ensured the liberation, independence, and advancement of the black community in the United States. However, the imperialist capitalist system is not designed to liberate the oppressed, but to gain the ultimate benefit from their oppression.
Well, I would like to welcome a former U.S. political prisoner to Hidden Files, who was incarcerated for 49 years.
Jalil Montarem, former member of the Black Panthers Party, which he joined at 16, and founding member of the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. He was incarcerated at age 19, and he was freed at age 69. He spent almost 15 years in prison. He was released in October of 2020. Jalil Montarem established the first revolutionary newspaper from prison and continues to be active. He started from inside prison, a national campaign to recognize political prisoners. He also started a UN petition against the U.S. having political prisoners.
Well, thank you for joining us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Montarem. How do you define a political prisoner?
How do we grade these categories and define who they are as a result of their resistance of being dissenters to a system of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism? For us, our comrades are freedom fighters, right? They identify them as being terrorists. Why are they terrorists? Because they're opposing the ideals and the practices of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism. Right? They are trying to alleviate our oppression, right, by any means necessary, as El Hajj Malik Shabazz has instructed us, by any means necessary. And so therefore they criminalize us, right, and bring us to criminal court in order to charge us what they call criminal offenses, right, on their books, right, in order to protect their interests, protect the state, right? And so this is the reason why they don't want to identify us as political prisoners, because they criminalize our movement. They criminalize our people. They criminalize our movement, right? We've been engaging in war against black people since 1619, all right, if you really want to understand it, all right? When they had the black codes, they had Jim Crow, right? And they have mass incarceration, right? The school-to-prison pipeline, right? It's all criminalizing our lives, right? Our efforts to be actually totally free and emancipated, right, people. And so that is the reason why they criminalize us, don't want to give us recognition, right, and understanding that there is divisions in this country, right, as a result of white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, past and race divisions in this country, and that there are people grappling with this idea that at some point in time, we have to free ourselves from a system that has been oppressing us for the last 400 years.
Well, from your experience, do you think that political prisoners are treated differently than the average prisoner?
We find that political prisoners are naturally distinguished from the regular general prison population. And the reason why is because they're educated. They're educated and they understand the nature of their relationship to the state. And therefore, they try to remove those individuals from the population because they do not want the general population to be educated and understand what is the relationship to the state in regards to being an antagonistic relationship they have with the state, particularly based upon race and class. And so for me, naturally, being an organizer in prison, I haven't been organized outside prison, been organized inside prison, I often was targeted by prison officials to be put in solitary confinement and or have other types of harassments and being deprived of certain privileges that most prisoners get. They would deprive me of that. But the only thing that did made me stronger, made me fight harder, that's all.
Well, do you think that it has been proven to the international community that political prisoners exist in the U.S., though Washington denies it?
Excellent question. You are absolutely correct. The United States does not recognize the fact that they do have political prisoners. When I first put in my, I'll give you an example. When I first submitted my campaign, U.S. Petition campaign to the United Nations, this was back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I had the opportunity to have a question asked of then UN ambassador to the United Nations by a guy named by the name of Andrew Young, the first black UN ambassador to the United Nations under the presidency of Jimmy Carter. And the question I had asked him by a journalist who was, when he was in Paris at a press conference, was, does political prisoners exist in the United States? And Andrew Young answered in the affirmative, positively, said perhaps thousands. You can Google New York Times, Andrew Young, political prisoners, and all those articles will come up. He was vilified in the press, vilified by the elite for having made that truthful statement and passed 1,000 political prisoners in the United States. And he was called to the carpet in the White House and told him to shut that down. Why do they do that? They do that because they don't want the world to know that there is dissent in the United States, right? They project themselves as being the moral of humanitarian leader of the world, and that is a false. That's a falsehood, right? They are the greatest harbinger of and progeny of violence in the world. Not my words; those are the words of Dr. Martin Luther King prior to his being assassinated. He said the United States is the greatest progenitor of violence in the world, and we understand that. We know that.
Well, do you see a connection between the oppression of black Americans and the oppression of people worldwide?
One of the things I told the community, international community, that their freedom depends mostly on our freedom, right? Black people's freedom in the United States, right? I informed them specifically that when we are free, you will be free, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because we are in the bastion of white supremacy, you see? And so for us, If this empire, what we call the United States, which is in fact is an empire, right? Well, an octopus, right? You can see the tentacles all over the world, right? Well, they're sucking the blood and sucking the resources and sucking the labor from various, particularly mostly people of color countries around the world, right? Now, those who engage in struggles for national liberation and independence, to end colonialism, neocolonialism,